Members, I call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Jacob, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from March 3rd for approval?
I have looked at them. I move approval.
Members, Representative Jacob moves the minutes from March 3rd. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We have minutes approved. On the agenda for today, members, we're going to hear from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on grants management. And then after they wrap, the DNR is here to do a presentation on the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund Community Grant Program report. You should have that report in your packet, and I'm sure we'll have a good discussion on that. If the folks from the OLA would like to make their way, that would be perfect. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and go ahead, that would be just fine.
All right. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Catherine Tyson. I'm a Deputy Legislative Auditor at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm here today to talk briefly about requirements state agencies must meet when they're administering grants. As the chair just noted, after me, you're going to be hearing from the Department of Natural Resources about its plan to administer or start up and administer a brand new grant program. And I'd really like to commend the committee for its proactive attention to any risks that this might be facing this new program, as well as its attention to the ways in which the department might be able to mitigate those risks while meeting the program's statutory purpose and objectives. So first, just a bit of background on grants management. Both state law and the Office of Grants Management, or OGM, provide requirements granting agencies must meet when administering grants. Specifically, OGM has developed 13 grants management policies that state agencies must follow. And these policies govern all phases of grant-making process, including procedures that must occur before a grant is awarded and before the contract is executed, as well as for procedures that occur throughout the life of the grant and at the closeout of the grant. So today I'm going to touch on a couple of requirements related to three specific areas: pre-award risk assessments of potential grantees, grant payments, and also grant monitoring. I did produce a one-pager that you should have in your packet if you want something tangible to hold on to while I'm speaking. Starting with the pre-award risk assessment process, pre-award risk assessments are a formal analysis that of risks of potential grantees and the risk of whether they can or that they cannot or will not be able to perform the duties specified in the grant agreement. Risk assessments are intended to protect the interests of the state as well as ensure effective and timely delivery of publicly funded grant programs and services. State law requires agencies to perform pre-award risk assessments for any grant of $50,000 or more. And among other things, agencies are required to evaluate the potential grantee's past performance, duties that might be similar to those required by the grant, as well as the potential grantee's financial information. For example, state agencies may review information such as a potential grantee's audits, financial statements, and federal and state tax forms. Potential grantees are required by law to certify that none of their principals have been convicted of a felony financial crime in the past 10 years, and state grant-making agencies are required by policy to verify that potential grantees have not been debarred by the state or the federal government. Based on the risks identified during the risk assessment, grant agencies may provide enhanced oversight of the grant, provide technical assistance to the potential grantee, or decline to award grants. Once a grant has been awarded and the grant contract agreement is fully executed, a grantee may begin work on the grant and receive payments from a granting agency. According to state grant-making policy, reimbursement is the preferred method for making grant payments. This process would be where a grantee performs the work, submits an invoice or a request for reimbursement to the state agency, and then the state pays the grantee after some review of that request. Agencies are allowed to provide advance or upfront grant payments, but state policy says that this method is not the preferred method. Before making an advance payment, agencies must be confident that a grantee would be able to abide by the terms and the conditions of the grant agreement based on that grantee's past performance and based on an evaluation of that grantee's recent financial statements. State grantmaking policy requires agencies to prepare a written justification of the need to use an advance payment process, and all advance payments on grants must be negotiated between the agency and the grantee on a case-by-case basis. Moving to requirements about grant monitoring, during the time that a grant is active, agencies are expected to monitor grants. State law, in fact, says granting agencies must diligently administer and monitor any grants they have entered into. State grantmaking policy requires agencies to conduct at least one monitoring visit and one financial reconciliation of all state grants over $50,000. Grants over $250,000 need at least one annual monitoring visit. Monitoring visits are allowed by policy to be in person or via telephone. They might include discussions about the grantee's compliance with legal requirements or with the requirements of the grant. They might include discussions about the grantee's ability or its progress meeting the grant outcomes, as well as that grantee's policies or procedures. So just to wrap this up, if you were listening closely, you might have noticed that I mentioned a couple of requirements where there's a threshold at $50,000. Specifically, grants under $50,000 are not required to have a pre-award risk assessment completed on the potential grantee, nor is the granting agency required to conduct monitoring visits or financial reconciliations. History tells us that these controls can help mitigate risks of improper payments in the program. Improper payments can be errors, they can be theft, they can be fraud, just payments that are not proper for that grant. However, controls like these, they also come with resource costs, of course. It takes time for staff to conduct pre-award risk assessments. It takes time to do monitoring visits and financial reconciliation. And as we frequently assess in our audits, these controls are only as effective as the structure an agency has built to support them, such as providing the staff who conduct these processes adequate supervision and training, as well as implementing reviews of staff compliance and grant-making policies and procedures. As you all know, as policymakers, it's often up to you to determine how much risk you're willing to accept in programs. And as I said earlier, I really appreciate this committee having a discussion about how to design a new program to achieve its statutory objectives while maintaining program integrity. With that, Mr. Chair, I've concluded my planned remarks, but I'm happy to take questions about grant-making policies.
Representative Jacob, you're first on my list for questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And thank you for this kind of, it almost seems like a, you know, a bit of a caution, is what I'm reading here. And I'm used to seeing payments come largely by reimbursement. So I guess the question is, how common is it to do advance payments across state agencies?
Deputy Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob, we definitely do see grants that are paid through an advanced process. I think typically we see grants that are paid through a reimbursement, but it really depends on the specific grant, the specific agency, you know, the processes they've set up.
Representative Jacob.
Yeah. So, and you know, I kind of, like I said, I just kind of heard somewhat of a cautionary tone here. Should we be concerned that this needs to be watched more closely with advance payments with respect to fraud?
Ms. Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob, There's the possibility of putting additional controls onto advanced payments. There's probably a whole range of options that that an agency could place. So, for example, retaining a percentage of that payment until final, like the grant has concluded, until the final evaluation has occurred. There's that possibility. There's possibilities to do enhanced oversight, like doing surprise visits or surprise audits of the grantee. So I think there's ways that agencies can establish controls for advance payments.
Okay. Very well, thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that overview. So I heard you say that in the pre-award risk assessment, you may do things like look at 990s and tax forms. Can you explain, like, what percentage of the time does that happen that you are aware of? For me, that feels like a very basic baseline. And perhaps why that's not a common practice and sounds like perhaps optional. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, that's a really excellent question. I don't think I can speak to the percentage of grants overall that may or may not have these risk assessments. I think the important thing to note is that the law requires grants of $50,000 or more to have these. And so grants are smaller, are not required. Agencies are not required to do these pre-award risk assessments. The law requires that agencies do certain things. In the review of the agency's financial statements, if they have an audit or tax forms, the law is a bit permissive. It says in making this assessment, the agencies must review the following information as applicable. It might depend on the situation, if it's a new organization, if it's one that's existed for a while, if it's for-profit, if it's nonprofit, and that's kind of built in the law. And so when I used May, that was what I was referring to.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I wasn't sure if this was like in rulemaking or if this was in statute, but just to clarify, it sounds like it's how that's written in statute and then with that 50,000 threshold. I just want to make sure I got that right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, yes, it's Minnesota Statute 16B.981.
So, members, I don't have any more. Oh, Mr. Co-Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Co-Chair Einsman. A question I have is you're going over a number of things that may be considered or people should look at in terms of pre-awards, et cetera. Guide rails out there. One of the things I didn't notice as I was going through these things is we've talked a lot about detecting and preventing, but also the other part that goes with it is what are we doing to get the money back? And one of the things that I've seen that's been very successful and having worked in the nonprofit world as a CFO, things that I've had to work with on our grants is always making sure that we have surety bonds, making sure that we've got the dollar amounts out there to cover it. Right now, is that required anywhere? Do we even mention the need to, the thought of having surety bonds to make sure that if something goes wrong, we've got a way to get the taxpayer money back.
Ms. Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Fisher, I want to just start on the first comment you made about detecting and preventing fraud, any other improper payments. Yes, it's always more cost effective, it's more efficient to detect these types of things before they even get off the ground. In terms of surety bonds, the legislature has required certain programs or entities that do business with the state to have surety bonds, sometimes even fidelity bonds. The thing that comes to mind for me immediately is in the medical assistance programs, certain providers are required to have surety and fidelity bonds. I think that would be a fantastic discussion to continue with the executive branch about the possibility of that. My thought at this moment is that's something that you could consider.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair Fisher.
Thank you for that. And it's one of the things as I'm mentioning it is that I know that depending which government unit we were working with, et cetera, when we're having it, if there was an added cost, that would be allowable. They were allowing that as an allowable extra expense out there. And the reason I bring that up, particularly as we were talking about the small grant awards, the program that we're looking at, this is one of the things we've been wrestling with. How do we make sure that for small grantees that are going to put out there who may not have a lot of experience or even have the money to put up front, you know, to be able to do the expense put up front, what are ways that we can put out there to make sure that people who are doing the want to do the right work and out there making sure we're giving them the tools, but making sure we're protecting our tax dollars in the process. This could be one of the methods that we should consider in having out there. I know it's evidently new. I kind of just assumed we always did that because of all the grants that I had to do, the government grants where we always had to do it. But it's one something I want to toss out there because we want to make sure that we've got everything covered from beginning to end here. And this could be one of the tools that could help give comfort as we're dealing with this. So just want us to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Members, I should mention that Chair Fisher and I have been talking this through together offline, working to make sure that we're all on the same page. And that's part of the reason that we're having the hearing that we are today. Ms. Thiessen, if you had any response, I just want to give you a chance.
Not at the moment.
All right, then I will just confirm your availability throughout the hearing today. We're going to have DNR up next, and I'm sure there'll be more questions that will likely include you. So if DNR could begin to make their way to the testifier's desk. Assistant Commissioner, it's good to see you here today.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you so much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner DNR. I'm just going to be kicking us off here. And we're bringing up Catherine Sherman Honan from our grants unit supervisor, because I know she was intimately involved in writing the report, and there will be questions for her. So rather than have to phone a friend, we're going to have our friend here with us. So with that, thank you for your interest in this report. This is a culmination of language that came out of last year's legislature, requiring us to do a outline of the grant program. The report has been accepted, or I think we've received a lot of reception, good reception on it. We're here to walk through it with you and hear your comments and try to figure out how do we get this program running with everybody supporting it. It's very important, and we're excited to get it implemented. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mary and Catherine.
Go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Robison, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you so much for having us here today. And again, want to just express thanks for having us here alongside the Office of the Legislative Auditor so they can talk about the requirements that Office of Grants Management sets for us as a floor or a baseline for grant monitoring and oversight requirements. So look forward to the discussion today. Just to provide some background before we launch into the implementation, the NRTF Community Grant Program was established in the 23 session in Minnesota Statutes 116X for the benefit of current residents and future generations. And just as a reminder, per the statute, the grants must be for the purposes authorized for the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund within the state constitution, and must also expand the number and diversity of recipients who benefit from ENRTF funds, especially in communities adversely affected by pollution and environmental degradation. Again, under 116X, the grants must be awarded for the following purposes, which you can see in the presentation, helping adversely impacted communities respond to environmental degradation, education and awareness related to stewardship of air, land, water, forests, fish, wildlife, and other natural resources, preserving and enhancing air, land, water, and other natural resources that have otherwise been impacted, trail maintenance and improvement, and aquatic invasive species management. Per the requirements in the report, just to go through that the structure is, we were required to provide recommendations to ensure that the program operates in a similar level in a similar way to the Conservation Partners Legacy Program. So we'll go through the similarities and differences between those two programs, the details of program implementation, and the organizational structure and membership of the Environment
and Natural Resources Trust Fund Community Grants Advisory Council, which is also created in 116X. And we'll talk about this a little bit further, but the Advisory Council application is currently open and will be open through April 10th. So in terms of where we are now, as others have said, we are just entering the implementation of this program and look forward to the legislature's feedback on the framework provided in the report. I think the biggest, most important point that we can make today is that we, the DNR, believe that we can meet the goals of this program to expand access to Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund funding across the state and also meet the requirements that we need to for internal controls, including meeting or exceeding the requirements in policy and statute that the OLA just overviewed in terms of the Office of Grants Management policies and requirements. In fact, I think it's vitally important that we do both those things as public servants, make sure that the funding is available to people throughout the state to serve the public, and also make sure that those dollars are used appropriately. As I already mentioned, our immediate next step is to start this advisory council, and that application process is open through April 10th. We do want to get that advisory council up and running before we get too much further into the implementation of this program. In terms of the contents of the report and the pieces that we have been asked, again, the DNR does administer Outdoor Heritage Fund grants and ENRTF grants that have been appropriated through the LCCMR process. For those of you who might be familiar with the department, it is the same group that administers those Outdoor Heritage Funds pass-through grants and LCCMR grants that will be overseeing the community grant program, so the same management structure there. This group administers a very high volume and complexity of grants. We have around over 500 pass-through grants open at any given point through the legislatively named grants that we receive. And this same team provides guidance on compliance to over 50 different grant programs across the department. So that's where this department would sit. In terms of the Community Grant Program and Conservation Partners Legacy, which is a program within the Outdoor Heritage Fund grants, they are established for similar legislative purposes to increase capacity within Minnesota to address environmental and natural resources issues and expanding access to funding. So that's part of why this comparison is appropriate and important. In terms of similarities between the two programs, both programs would provide enhanced technical assistance and guidance to grantees to help them through their application and through the administration of the grant. In both programs, we use or would use, in the case of the community grant program, technical experts for application review and project consultation. And similar to CPL, we would envision both a standard round of grants for the community grant program and expedited rounds that are designed to go faster and do sort of on-the-ground shovel-ready projects. And we can talk more about that as we go through the implementation plan. But it's a similar model there in terms of two different rounds and types of grants going on simultaneously. There are some differences between the two programs. We do not envision that the community grants program would require match as part of lowering barriers to participation. We also would allow for the use of fiscal agents. Fiscal agents are larger, more established organizations that are experienced in grant administration that could come in and apply alongside smaller organizations to help them with grant administration and financial oversight. And that would be part of our oversight structure in those cases. As I've already mentioned multiple times, the community grant program does have an advisory council as established in law, so that is different between the two programs. And we also hope in the community grants program to allow for greater flexibility in administrative expenses and support as part of capacity building efforts for smaller organizations across the state. The advisory council, the membership structure, terms, duties, and experience requirements are all outlined in Minnesota Statutes 116X. So we will be following that, obviously, to the letter. We have an open and competitive process currently open that will identify 14 to 19 members. The exact number of members will depend on the amount needed to satisfy the qualifications and the demographics that are established in law. And council members will be required to disclose and appropriately manage potential or perceived conflicts of interest. In terms of the implementation plan, as I've mentioned, we envision standard and expedited rounds similar to Conservation Partners Legacy. Expedited grants would need to be ready to go and therefore could not include like capital projects or land acquisition that are just longer processes across the board. We want ready to go and quicker grants. We would envision two expedited rounds per year and one standard round. Expedited grants would be up to 50,000 and standard grants up to 750. And to meet programmatic goals, as again outlined in law, our criteria would include past access to ENRTF dollars, or at least consider that, as well as locations relative to environmental justice areas. That is an applicant inside, outside, or partly within an environmental justice area? And just a reminder that environmental justice areas are defined in state statute in terms of how they are calculated. Again, we are very committed to meeting both the goals of the program to expand funding and establishing adequate internal controls in every way. In terms of expanding access to the program, to the funding, we would have various supports for that, including financial management support and technical assistance, application support, and allowance for administrative expenses. In terms of fiscal controls, the program will be implemented in full accordance with state laws and policies that you heard the OLA discuss, including the use of pre-award financial reviews and grant monitoring. Again, Office of Grants Management policies set a floor from which we can work. And the DNR would use its 5% administrative budget that's allowed in law in order to provide both those things, both the supports for grantees and the fiscal controls. That's partially why administrative funding for grants is so important, because it allows for that work. I do know that there have been a number of questions specifically about the possibility of advance payments, so I just want to take a second to address that briefly. We did discuss in the report the possibility of providing advance payments for grants under $50,000, and the committee is right to ask questions about that. I do not disagree with anything, or I would say we do not disagree with anything that the OLA has said about reimbursement being the preferred model and the default model for grants across the state. That is absolutely true. And when we think about other programs like the Outdoor Heritage Fund pass-through grants that we talked about in the Legacy Committee yesterday, that's something where we do not do advance payments, because those are larger organizations that don't need that kind of upfront funding to do the work. This program, because it is intended to get money out to new groups and new audiences, part of what it is envisioned to do is work with smaller organizations. And we are prepared for the idea that some of those organizations might not be able to cash flow upfront even amounts under $50,000. And so part of what we need to consider is how we would do an advance payment option to allow those groups to participate. If we were going to do that, we would follow all of the requirements of Office of Grants Management policy or exceed them. And just some examples of how we would go ahead and do that. There is no blanket, we have no intention of doing any sort of blanket program that would do advance payments. That would not be acceptable. It would be on a case-by-case basis in which we would review, develop a criteria to review an organization's need, and an organization would need to defend their need for those advance payments, as I believe the OLA spoke to. If they were able to demonstrate a need, we would then need to put in place controls that would meet or exceed all of the Office of Grants Management policies, including reconciliation and oversight, certainly not giving out the entire grant amount, you know, in advance. So we'd have to figure out a schedule in which we could give out a portion of funding and monitor the grant as we go. And welcome any questions or concerns about that, because, again, understanding that advance payments do have additional risk, so we need to make sure we have that monitoring and clawback in place if we're going to go ahead and do this as part of the achieving the goals of the program. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would open it up for questions.
Sure. I'll go ahead and lead off the questions today. Next up will be Representative Schultz. So my first question is going to be a bit blunt. Mm-hmm. That is, was the $50,000 threshold for small grants selected simply to avoid the additional OGM requirements?
Chair Heinzman, for the record, my name is Catherine Sherman-Hohen. I am the agency-wide grants manager for the Department of Natural Resources. It was selected not to avoid the requirements, but in recognition of the fact that the requirements for $50,000 and above are designed by the Office of Grants Management for more robust granting. And when we wanted to be able to expedite the process for smaller grants, the intent is not that we will not be doing pre-award financial capacity checking or monitoring. It's that this allows us to suit those activities to the size of the grant. So we still will be making sure that any grantee under $50,000 has the financial capacity and the internal controls to successfully administer the grant and is in fact a valid grantee and organization and is not debarred. All of that will happen, but this allows us to do it in a slightly more condensed format than the list of questions and back and forth and then timeline given in the statute. It also, the same would hold true for monitoring, that it allows us to look at other monitoring activities rather than just one site visit and do visits to sites as part of other work to look at asking the monitoring questions to make sure that the grant is working the way it needs to in a variety of contacts with the organization, for instance, at payment time, rather than saying that every grant has to have just one visit. So the intent is not to not monitor or to not do pre-award checks. It's to give us flexibility to design that in a way that works best for the grantee and for the DNR to get those answers and make sure that the organizations are compliant, are fiscally responsible, and are spending money the way they need to in the course of a shorter grant that may actually be over before a particular year is done, and get them off and running quickly.
I appreciate that answer. I'll just be totally transparent. That particular issue is more than anything else causing a lot of consternation. And I think there's going to be a lot more conversation about that today and going forward. I would just ask, again, just being completely blunt, if anyone at the table today wants to take ownership of that particular decision to create this threshold of $50,000 and under this expedited grant program, because at some point the buck is going to stop. And mm-hmm. I think all of our members here today recognize that we don't want this to become the downfall of the community grants program. So if anyone wants to own that today, you're more than welcome, but I'll move on to other questions if not. Doesn't appear to be.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Go ahead.
I would say that was a discussion that we had internally that was discussed amongst our team. I'm happy to take my fair share of responsibility for that, and I expect that all of us can and will be held accountable for the administration of this program, both through the annual reports that are required for us to provide every February, as well as OLA audits. So we fully expect that we will be held accountable to the full administration of this program, and we don't just expect it, we welcome it.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Minnesota is blessed that we have this opportunity to ensure strong program integrity measures, and this hearing is incredibly important, especially considering you all have spent a lot of time, presumably over the last year, putting this plan together. And I just wanted to ask from an outset, as I review this, I wanted to see, is there anyone that you consulted with, or is this wholly within your team that you came up with this current model?
Mr. Chairman.
Assistant Commissioner, go ahead.
I will start off with that response, and thank you for that response or question, Representative Schultz. We did work internally, as Director Robeson said, her staff and team pulled this report together. They did brief the commissioner. We did approve it and release it. I did share it with our chairs, both in the House and Senate, and I, at that point in time, received no comments. I did receive several comments after the report about some of the things we're talking about today, but it was at the roundtable when we had the conversation, and all three of the chairs had agreed that we can go ahead and release the report. So we did consult with our chairs before we did release the report, waiting for comments. I had conversations with staff after that fact, but we did check in before we released the report.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm led to believe that, based upon what you just said, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, that you did not consult with outside organizations in building this this model. And so then I am really curious if you, along those same lines, when considering the expedited and standard models here, if you consulted with any outside organizations in that regard.
It looks like there might have been a little bit of back and forth at the table, so you might want to take those questions as pieces and maybe address the previous question again if there was any misunderstanding. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saltz, thank you again for your question. In terms of meeting with outside groups, this program did come about as a result of stakeholder engagement and work. It was not generated from the DNR. Those groups have provided, you know, their recommendation or vision at the beginning when the law was established. And so some of that perspective is reflected there. But during the time that we were drafting the report, after the time that it was required of us to the time it was released, we did that internally. We took into account conversations that had already happened, but we drafted the report internally. And specifically to your question, the decision around expedited rounds versus standard rounds, those were all decisions made internally, not externally.
Representative Schultz, there might have been a little bit more there, so if you want to reiterate your question.
Right. Anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see a grand difference in the plans here between a standard and an expedited model. As someone who sits on the fraud committee, been watching the immense amount of fraud that we have seen in Minnesota, program integrity measures must be put into place to protect the public's money, including dollars that are meant for this community grants program. And so I am led to just question what and from whom did this desire come from for an expedited grants process?
Sure.
Ms. Robson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, I would also point out that part of the requirement of the report was to have us look at structuring the program similar to the Conservation Partners Legacy Program, which again does have standard and expedited rounds at the same thresholds. So this structure that is here is already in place in the Conservation Partners Legacy space with the Outdoor Heritage Funds.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I read the report, I have it here, I marked it up wholly, what I saw in it was just a specific desire to get the dollars out as fast as possible. That's the way that the report reads. It says that the expedited grant process is for the desire of getting out as quickly as possible. I want to say that it's like June 30th of this year is a reason for the expedited grant process. That doesn't give me confidence that we are adhering to the principles that should be at play when protecting the public's dollars.
If there was a question, go ahead.
It's fine.
Representative Schultz, if you have more questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then thinking a little bit more about this, what does the shorter risk assessments entail for expedited grants?
Go ahead.
Chair Heinzman, Representative Schultz. While we are still building the templates for them, the shorter risk assessments would still look at making sure that no one who is disbarred could be a grantee, that the organization is actually an organization in good standing with the Secretary of State, that the organization has no one who's been convicted of a financial felony, that the organization has a fiscal capacity that is sufficient to meet the needs of the grants itself and internal controls as well. I am without my notes on that particular program, but those are the key elements, and anything else, I could go back and take a look at the notes we have and respond more fully as needed to, just to make sure I haven't forgotten anything.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and certainly we'll be continuing this conversation beyond today, and I think that these are just the questions that we have in this room today. And so as we think about this, and I'll turn it back over to the chair in a moment, I was a little bit concerned considering the expedited grant process that is proposed, in addition to the advanced payments idea, in addition to what you said, which is that you don't have that criteria available to us today. Those are all things that have me alarmed. Alarmed today, given that the principle outlined in this report is to get the money out the door as quick as possible. We need to protect the public's money. Thank you.
Representative Purcell. Representative Jordan, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some questions about grant monitoring. I know there were some concerns that the, and I don't know if whoever wants to take this, I won't direct it. I'll let you air traffic control this one, Mr. Chair. But I had some questions about grant monitoring. I know at one point there were concerns that it maybe wasn't happening. I'm also interested in the difference between doing how the DNR does grant monitoring via telephone versus in person. That just seems a little bit odd to me. And I'm also just wondering if these grant monitoring, like site visits, are scheduled in advance. I mean, I recognize that it can be hard to show, like, prairie restoration, you know, like plants. We don't get to tell the plants how to grow as much as we would like to. But so there's some, I think, interesting challenges with that. So I'm wondering if you can talk about what you've done since the OLA report on grant monitoring and what that looks like in practice and if any changes have been made, and then just kind of those nuances.
I love the direct traffic, but I'll let whoever wants to take the question.
All right. Representative Heinzman, Chair Heinzman, Representative Jordan, I think the report you're referring to is the one that we heard yesterday in House Legacy on the OLA report on outdoor heritage funds. Monitoring there, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor is here if I get any of this wrong. Monitoring there was found to be generally adequate. We had a few instances where, you know, the sampling methodology we used for outdoor heritage funds, because we do have 480 open grants at a time, the sampling methodology that we are allowed to use by the Office of Grants Management and did use, there were a few instances where we had not written down all of the grants that were coming under a particular sample. And so it was not clear that we had monitored those. We had monitored the programs of which those grants were a part and had monitored all of the activities for them. Within the pass-through grants program, which is the unit at the DNR that would also be administering these grants. Sorry, the grants unit would be administering these. Pass-through grants would essentially be a sister program. We have taken steps already. In fact, before the audit began, we had already at the DNR used a continuous improvement process to determine that there were some areas where we were insufficiently documenting. We had already begun to create a new method that was going to make sure all of those were documented, everything was covered. We rolled that out spring of 2025. And have continued to use it for this year along with some revisions based on what we saw in 2025, just to make it a little more streamlined for DNR grant specialists. It has been working as intended for getting all documentation. So that's to that report. Please let me know if you've got any follow-up there.
Representative Jordan.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have the privilege of sitting on Legacy anymore, and so I'm trying to catch up. There's a lot of different ways that this is all melding together, so I'm trying to keep up, but I will, per usual, likely have a follow-up question.
No, Representative Jordan, you actually raise, I think, a really important point, because we do need to look at both subject areas, whether it's the OLA report that was brought up in the Legacy Committee yesterday. I referenced it a couple of times. For the benefit of members, that report looked at $15 million of grants and in approximately $550,000 of dollars that were dispersed. Issues were found, as was just mentioned, and it sounds like DNR is looking to provide corrective measures to avoid those incidents again. And it is, to the point of relevance, critical that we're making sure that if we can find some solutions that have worked in that subject area, that it's maybe something that can help us stand up this program here and avoid the same problems that the OLA brought forward in the Legacy Committee yesterday. Representative Jordan.
And thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Maybe that helps me kind of clarify what helps me decide on the question that I have, which is obviously outdoor heritage. We're talking about gigantic grants to well-established, enormous national organizations like Pheasants Forever, et cetera. Here we're talking about something that could be as small as the, like, Marshall Terrace Neighborhood Association in Northeast Minneapolis that wants to do some. Like, how do these, like, program integrity, what have we learned, what works, and what is just going to have to be very different, because there's a huge difference between a neighborhood association in Northeast Minneapolis and a Pheasants Forever.
Mr. Holm.
Chair Heinzman, Representative Jordan, that is the question we ask ourselves all of the time as we are doing this. Controls really need to be tailored to the kind of grant program and the kind of work that is being done, or they're not effective. For instance, I just described the sampling method with outdoor heritage funds. That's not a method that we would anticipate using with these particular funding sources, because we do not have a large number of grants. We're not anticipating a large number of large grants of very similar size and scope run by the same organization on the same project. So sampling methodology would not be appropriate for these grants. So that's just an example of ways where these grants will look different from Outdoor Heritage Fund. We also administer the pass-through grants for the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And many of those grants are very large to well-known organizations, but a larger proportion of them are small and to new organizations. And we have had the advantage of being able to work with Executive Director Becca Nash and her team on those over the years to really see what kinds of controls we need to put in place for smaller programs and smaller organizations. We all also have the learnings of a lot of other DNR grant programs and other spaces. Some examples of those that I can think of that we are intending to use on this program are technical assistance, especially for new grantees, that comes at the start of the grant, that actually, when possible, is a visit to that grantee at the start of the grant, like a physical visit, to set us up for success, to help answer their questions, make sure that their internal controls are going to be adequate. Those, again, I'm using those as examples because it depends on what we find in pre-award capacity checks and in other discussions with the grantee. More frequent visits. Site visits are a very useful tool to see the work being done on the ground. They are sometimes not the most useful tool to see all of the fiscal information and backup documentation, and that is where virtual visits, we really don't do telephone, we do Teams meetings where we can actually share documents back and forth, bring up things we have questions about, and grantees provide a lot of documentation both at payment time and at monitoring time. So that's an example of where you use a site visit to determine what's happening on the ground. You use the virtual visit to discuss, ask questions about what's going on in all of the paperwork, and then come for backup documentation if you need to. Are those good? Okay.
Just for the benefit of the committee, I'll just point out what I'm going to refer to quickly. This is Department of Natural Resources Outdoor Heritage Fund grant performance audit that was just mentioned a few moments ago. And on page 11, which you don't have, but it's something that you could refer back to, members, if you would like to get access to that particular report. Some of the findings on page 11 are DNR did not obtain adequate documentation for $404,000 in costs, including reimbursement payments. Page 13, DNR did not conduct the required number of monitoring visits for four legislatively named grants and two grants from the DNR appropriation. And then on page 14, DNR issued payments to grantees with past due progress reports and did not obtain all required progress reports from grantees. So just making sure that we're all kind of reading from the same music there and that we have all the same information. In that discussion just a moment ago between Representative Jordan and the panelists, the testifiers, I just want to push back on the idea that one thing or another would not be appropriate. It really is up to this body to decide what is appropriate in terms of guidelines, guardrails, and so on and so forth. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. So it seems like we're kind of trying to expedite the grants that are under 50,000. But then, I mean, we've got projects of all size, but then the standard grants, they're limited to 750,000. So can you explain to me why that limit's put there? I'll say, like, especially early on in the program.
Who would like that? Do you want to go ahead? Go ahead.
Chair Heinzman, Representative Jacob, and I'll start out with, it was never our intent to try and say that something was appropriate or not absent what this committee would have given us leeway to do, or the legislature. And Representative Jacob, the $750,000 threshold isn't related to any Office of Grants Management or other risk-related threshold. That threshold was set in place to balance the fact that we are trying to, by statute, we are trying to expand the diversity and number of organizations receiving trust fund grants, with the fact that some projects, notably trail projects, might be higher dollar value. Also some of the restoration, and the fact that this comes out of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So it's a balancing act of how do we make sure that we have enough grants available to award to really expand the number of organizations, as is in statute, along with making sure that we have a high enough dollar of value that some of the more labor-intensive grants can actually do their work. And also the fact that the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, continues to give out grants and has a much higher dollar threshold and is available for organizations that would be looking at doing projects that would be in the millions of dollars.
Representative Jacob.
One follow-up. Chair Heinzman, did I understand you're specifically trying to make sure money doesn't go to trails? Is that?
No. Chair Heinzman, Representative Jacobs, no, that is not the case. Trail grants are part of the statute. We absolutely expect that money will be going to trails. It's a matter of making sure that there is a balance between money going to trail maintenance and money going to the other uses in the project as well. And also the recognition of the fact that for very intensive kinds of trail maintenance, there are other there are other funding sources available.
Representative. Before we go to Representative Schultz, could you maybe, if you know off the top of your head, anyone who wants to take this, what is the generally average cost of maintenance for a mile of trail? I'll just use my own, in my own backyard, the Paul Bunyan Trail. And I have a ballpark idea because we've discussed it before. But so to rehab a mile of trail, what are we talking about? And the reason I'm even bringing it up is because the $750,000 max threshold.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's going to depend on number of different factors, but it's hundreds of thousands of dollars per mile for rehab of a trail. If you're going to grind it down to to base and redo it. That's going to be more expensive than just an overlay. I can certainly give you our current cost projections on trail rehab and repair. I'll provide it to the committee. It's part of our asset preservation bonding costs that are there, but it is hundreds of thousands of dollars per mile.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We could talk more about this going forward, but considering the huge cost that we're looking at with preserving assets, state assets, maintaining state trails, and so on and so forth, I think that you could argue that the $750,000 max is extremely limiting when it comes to getting these dollars out and actually having a significant impact statewide. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Jordan's questions are important when we're considering small grants and the people who will benefit from them. I think that the idea of using fiscal agents can assist in that, and it potentially provides an opportunity for us to not need advance payments, because sometimes those fiscal agents should be able to carry that ability to hold, again, up to $50,000, if that is the concept. There might be that ability to do that. And I'm just, you know, I don't know the circumstances of Northeast Minneapolis specifically, but if the city of Minneapolis could be that fiscal agent, wouldn't that provide that opportunity? And I mean that because I'm concerned about these advanced payments. I am like Representative Jacob in that the reimbursement model appears to be a stronger threshold for program integrity and security. And so I wanted to ask, along the lines of these advanced payments as presented here in the report, if the DNR is planning to limit either the number or the percentage of grants paid using an advanced payment option.
Chair Heinzman, Representative Schultz, we had not developed a particular number or percentage. The idea, honestly, is that they would only be used when other options are not available. Fiscal agents, reimbursement on a more frequent basis. We do very few advanced payments in the Department of Natural Resources. Out of 2,200 grants at the Department of Natural Resources right now, I'm trying to do the math in my head. I would say less than 20 are as far as I know, working on an advance payment basis. And the agency fiscal head does have to approve individually anyone that does.
Members, I'll just point out that we have 45 minutes, so I'm just going to continue to allow questions to move along. It looks like we have Representative Hansen, Gottfried, Nelson, Finke, and Fisher on the list, and I think we're in pretty good shape for that. Assistant Commissioner, do you have more to add on that?
Mr. Chairman, I just would like to make a statement. This report presents recommendations to the legislature on the grant program. We have not laid out an RFP. We have not said we're going to do advance payments. We have not said the categories are going to be 50,000, 750,000. So this is a great opportunity, a great discussion. We look forward to the legislature providing us more direction, hopefully in a bill, in a statutory framework that this program does not have right now. So thank you for the opportunity to have this discussion, and your input is very important. The success of this program is what we're bound to. We want to ensure that we are expanding the opportunity for people to get access to these dollars and these communities that cannot do that right now. So these are our recommendations. Just take that with a grain of salt. You implement, you impose, we dispose. So let's work together to get this right. Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner, I just want to say I really appreciate that. And that's a great contrast from what might or might not be appropriate. It just goes a long way, I think, with members today that are concerned about making sure this, again, this program is stood up in a way that we can all be proud of. So with that, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while the discussion was going on, I just scrolled through the Outdoor Heritage Bill and looked at the CPL appropriation. And, you know, one of the burdens of being here for a while, I remember some of these debates. And the technical evaluation panel, you know, we're spending $100+ million, and we have 160,000 going to look at projects after the fact. So we have a precedent in outdoor heritage to go out and see if a restoration or evaluation was done, that it was real, and to see if it was scientifically well done. That percentage, I think, is supposed to be 1% of the total appropriation, but generally it's a teeny tiny amount that's done. I think, you know, when we're at 15+ years for outdoor heritage, and if we look at LCCMR in general and these large appropriations, I also saw in the CPL grant that is the most micromanaged grant of all the big. The big grants have very broad authority, and then the CPL grant goes, if you do this and then that, and if you, you know, jump up on your right leg on the under a full moon, maybe you can get some more money. I mean, it's just very detailed and very specific. And if we're going to be looking at CPL, maybe we should look at all of this on both funds and see if there's a better way to be doing this, and if we can use science to go back post hoc. I'm not looking necessarily here at the issue of fraud. I'm looking at, if we fund a restoration, did it take? Is the land that we bought plowed up? Are these things actually happening year after year? So if we're going to enter into this, I'd like to expand it a little bit. I think we should do more post hoc science to see if we are purchasing something or restoring something or enhancing something that we, whether it's an LCCMR or the small grant program, go back 5 years afterwards and how is it working? Because that gives us data for the future on these longstanding funds. The LCCMR Trust Fund, or the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund, is perpetual. It just keeps going. Outdoor heritage is going to have to be back in front of the voters probably in 6 years. So I would just put that forward, that I think we should take a look at some of these criteria that have been boilerplate for a very long time and may not fit the world as they are right now, and how can we make it work for everybody better and use science that may not have existed 15 years ago to look at this and get a good product for the dollars that we invest.
Representative Hansen, I don't have the years that you do, but this is my 12th session, so I'm starting to see a pattern as years go along, and I see some of the same things that you're talking about in a very similar way. We might not use the same word, whether it be fraud or value or what have you, but I think generally the goals are the same, and that we're providing a good outcome for the people of Minnesota. Before we wrap today, I will be asking the OLA for their suggestion as to what we might do. They certainly have a lot of experience in confirming that programs are being executed properly. So just keep that in mind, members. Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, testifiers. The question I have pertains to some of the review beforehand for those expedited grants. I think when Representative Schultz was asking about some of the criteria that was used, several things were mentioned. One of them was being in good standing with the Secretary of State's office. That's statutory language, what good standing means. Another one that you mentioned was making sure, and this may not be your exact verbiage, but making sure basically that an organization that applied for a grant had the fiscal means to administer that grant. Can you speak a little bit more about what sort of things you're looking for when you're evaluating an organization's fiscal ability to administer a grant? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mahone.
Chair Heintzman, Representative Gottfried, and I'm going to be very general because this can get pretty detailed, and also will vary a little bit from organization to organization. But we are in general looking at, if you're under 50,000, that is under the 990, you're doing a postcard 990. So we're looking at the board certified financial statements to back that up. We are looking at their cash flow ratio, their debt ratio, essentially do they have enough money to be able to pay for the kinds of work that they are intending to do for us in advance. Do they have enough money that if we had a disallowed cost, they'd be able to pay it? You don't want to get in an organization and have them do work that puts them at risk. So If they don't have that kind of funding, we're looking at fiscal agents in that case, right? We are looking at their internal controls. Do they have separation of duties so that the same people aren't signing checks as are writing the contracts for them? We look at, do they have adequate conflict of interest so that they're making sure that people are not making decisions on that funding who have a financial interest in it in another way. Those are some of the key elements. I would honestly want one of our spreadsheets in front of me in order to go in more detail, but I actually could provide that if needed as a follow-up.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. That sounds like a pretty complex process, even for this expedited review or expedited grants. I guess, you know, in Chair Heinzman mentioned, you know, some areas in which in other grant programs that there was some lack of oversight of certain funds and things like that. And so with this level of complexity and understanding that there aren't many of these types of grants that you're administering, does, you know, the department, does DNR feel like they have the resources that they need in order to effectively oversee this new program, this and the current programs that you are overseeing currently? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Who would like that?
I'll take it. Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. In this particular case with the community grants program, the statute does allow us to use up to 5% for administration and would be using that amount of the appropriation to administer the grants, including the oversight that you're seeing. I do think as we build this program, recognizing that we are envisioning something that provides a lot of support for applicants and grantees, as well as a lot of oversight, if we are in a place where we do not think we have adequate resources in some way, then that would be a discussion for us to have with all of you, because we need to make sure that we are able to maintain the level of controls and the level of support that we're talking about today. And so we believe that we do have that with the 5% now, but we also recognize that we are just beginning to build this program, and so we don't know what we don't know. And so part of this entire thing is going to be learning as we go, adapting, making changes, you know, saying, is it working, is it not working? Not just in questions of do we have adequate administrative funding, but in all aspects of the program. You know, maybe we make a decision off the bat, or, you know, that we've discussed with all of you and it turns out to not be working. You know, we hope to change those things and do continuous improvement, because it isn't a one-shot deal. It's always a learning process. And I know this will certainly be for us.
Representative Gottfried, I think one of the suggestions earlier, and I'm not going to recall who, but somebody had suggested that maybe part of the dollars in the small grant category could be used for an surety bond. I mean, there's a whole host of ways that we may be able to get at this issue and I think address the concerns being raised today. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And, you know, looking through this report, you know, we've heard, you know, the difference of, you know, fiscal agents and, you know, sometimes the size of trails. Sometimes they go through multiple neighborhoods and things like that. And I'm looking on page 19, it talks about collaboration. And I'm wondering, would multiple, you know, the cost of rehabbing a trail or something like that, would multiple neighborhoods be able to collaborate and kind of stack some of these funds? Or maybe if you could just help me understand the collaboration there. Or is that allowing a stacking, or what would it allow?
Ms. Sherman-Hone.
Yep. Chair Heinzman, Representative Nelson, that is how we were conceiving it. For instance, multiple neighborhoods could go together, several organizations, each of which would play a role in kind of a coordinated project, could go in together. One of them would need to be the lead organization on it, but it would be key for us to know all of the organizations going in so that we could vet all of them as part of the RFP process.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And so if I'm understanding that if you had, say, three neighborhoods that were all wanting to rehab a trail or something, they would all, and one of them was the lead. All three could be eligible for the 750 up to that amount. So
that is correct.
Commissioner Hohen.
Thank you.
Representative Finke. Which Representative Finke, by the way, Girl Scout cookies that I received yesterday from your daughter, they were fabulous. So well, in case anybody is looking to make a purchase.
We made them ourselves. Yeah. No, but thank you for your business. And thank you. And I just wanted to, you know, Representative Schultz is no longer in the room, but he was talking about fiscal sponsored organizations and the small grants to the small groups. And I just wanted to speak up on behalf of those groups. I used to run a nonprofit that was very small, and we had a fiscal sponsor. And we had no money. And we had no cash. If there were no advancements, if there were no advance payments, right, like we just never would have done work. That's not how small nonprofit organizations function. You have to receive money in order to pay people and do work. And I think that that's really important. I guess as we build this program, I want to make sure, you know, I understand, but also the community understands who it's for. Because when I looked at the program, I thought, oh, $750,000 grants, that's big grants. Those are big grants to big organizations, not small grants to how I would understand a community organization. And then, you know, Chair was saying that that seems extremely limiting, a $750,000 grant under the community grants program. And I think, oh, we're going to go bigger than that. That just struck me as kind of counter to how I was understanding what this program was for, which is for community level projects at organizations who could really use financial support to do the work that Representative Hansen was talking about. And I don't bring this up to say we should or should not have larger grants. Like, I don't know the answer to that. That's the question that we will decide as a body. But I just want to make sure that we don't forget about, and we don't, you know, that this underrepresented groups who are trying to do work in their communities, that is what this program, in my understanding, was created to do. Not just underrepresented groups, but that's a part of it. And also small prairie projects and different people in different places who don't need a $1 million grant in order to do good for their community, to build a better Minnesota for everyone, as Representative Chair Heintzman was saying. So I guess, like, if I have a question, the question is, as you understand the charge, right, like we asked people to fund this community grant program, I'm just struggling to understand what we mean by community, right? Multi-district trails, I don't know that I think of that as community grant work. There are lots of ways for lots of people to get lots of dollars to do lots of different work, right? And I guess I just thought we were talking about community grants. I don't know that there's even a question there.
Representative Finke, I think that it's a very fair question because it's going to mean different things to different communities. And for some communities, it absolutely would be a trail. For another community, it might be trees. For another community, it might be what have you. If any of the testifiers here today want to address the comment, I think it's totally legitimately a concern or a question that many members might have. Assistant Commissioner.
Chair, I can attempt that. And thank you, Representative Finke, for that excellent question, because it is great. The trails category and the aquatic invasive species were two additional categories that came in after 116, after the constitutional amendment was adopted by the voters. And it was discussed at length, as you recall, last session, right? The first and foremost is to get, if you look at the language and statute, is to get these dollars in the hands that people couldn't participate in the first place. So looking at that lens, but I think Representative Heintzman looks at it a little bit differently as well. We'll take the Willard Munger Trail in Hinckley to St. Paul. That means a lot to Representative Nelson's district. It means a lot to members, districts, and communities all along the way. So much so that the MS, what is it, the 150, can't ride on the Hinckley Trail because it's so bad.
Which I have ridden, by the way. Thank you for mentioning that, Assistant Commissioner.
But we can't get enough money through bonding to take care of those large-scale types of projects at the cost they can. This provides those communities an opportunity to participate. Whatever your community is important to you, right? And the metropolitan area communities are going to be different than greater Minnesota communities. We are going to try to do the best we can to make sure these dollars get appropriated across all of the communities in all of Minnesota. Everybody contributes into this fund. Now, people will say the metropolitan area contributes more than the outstate Minnesota area. People from the metropolitan area recreate in outstate Minnesota. I spend time here in the cities. I spend most of my time in northern Minnesota when I can. I mean, it's different too. Every person is going to look at this a little bit differently. We are going to do the best we can to make that community of Minnesota eligible for these dollars. So we will do the best we can to make sure that we're working with the small groups and that everybody's needs are met. It's a challenge that is daunting, but one that we're voluntarily taking on and trying to make this work. So we will make sure that your voice is heard in this conversation as well and that everybody's voice is heard. So, and as I said, we are working with you all to stand this up. So thank you for your interest and your involvement in this conversation.
Representative Fisher. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Einsman. I appreciate it. Some of the questions I have are going to kind of cover a little bit or get into some of the areas that you were bringing up before. So I'm going to try to see where you can fit in on it. We were talking a little bit before about the 5%. Is that going to be enough or not? And part of where I get a little concerned on it is if we end up with a large number of very small grants, that's going to take a lot more capacity. And the reason I'm hitting on the 5% is one of the things is I've listened to the whole discussion over this past session about fraud issues, listening to what the OLLA has said on it, listened to different people in the departments. One of the things that has struck me is for a long time here in our state, we've spent so much time saying, oh, we got to limit the size of government. We've got to shrink the role of government. Part of what has happened as we've done that, we've always focused on, what we used to hear as priority is, we're not getting grants out fast enough. We need the people to do it. So we were always focusing on that, but saying, okay, we can't grow over a certain percent. You've got to keep it real small. And one of the things I think is that is now haunting us because as we're doing these ideas of trying to get things out quickly, trying to do that and keep government small, we forgot about the fact that we need the people who are qualified and trained to be able to do the follow-up and the audit afterwards. And that's why I'm raising 5% here is, that might be fine. I know that in DHS, they're proud saying it was under 3%, which we're saying now is just a terrible thing. It probably should be higher than what it is. But that means we have to hire more staff in there. And so that's why I'm kind of circulating. And I'm fine with that. I want to make sure we've got the programs well managed, that we've got grant managers who can understand and explain. Because one of the things I've heard from providers out there is when they got the grants, their grant manager couldn't explain what they needed for documentation, could not explain to them what the requirements were that for a site visit, that kind of thing. And so as a result, when it came time for things to be reconciled, they didn't always have the supporting documentation because the staff in the department weren't properly trained or were rushed in the process. And so I want to make sure that as we're hitting this, we're trying to get to the root cause in advance here. And this is what I like about the discussion and appreciate the way we're approaching this today. So one of the things, and first of all, the question I'm going to ask is not a condemnation, because I know what the answer is probably going to be, but it's trying to get us to think a little differently. So as the DNR was looking at putting the program together, did you ever spend time with the OLA office to see, are there other guidelines maybe we should have in there or tweak what we've got coming before you folks?
Sure.
We talked about that,
yeah. Ms. Robson?
Mr. Chair and Chair Fisher, thank you for the question. That's a conversation we have internally all the time, you know, because we want, in general, because we want to get that money out and on the ground, but we also know that we need to have adequate, you know, fiscal controls in place and staff that know the work and have the expertise. And, you know, I'll be quick, but grants are tremendously complicated and they are a professional role, and we need to make sure we have the expertise like Ms. Sherwin-Hohen, to do that well. So I really appreciate that question. In terms of have we worked with the OLA, we worked with the Office of Grants Management and talked to them about decisions and run things by them. We haven't worked carefully with the OLA yet. We would...
There's still time.
And we would welcome
doing that as we go through the program. We have, you know, this is just the beginning, as the report is a framework, so we haven't actually launched this program yet. The decisions laid out here haven't been fully made, and so we're happy to work with them and you as we go forward.
Assistant Commissioner, was there anything there? Otherwise, Chair Fisher.
I do have some more. And I want to say, it's what I raise is not a condemnation. It's just trying to put us in a new mindset when we're rolling out things. Is the impression I've gotten sometimes in the past is we engage the Office of Legislative Auditor too often after the fact, and when we're setting up new things, not getting involved in front of it. I think that's probably where you're going to go next, so I won't ask that question there. One of the things that I want to say that one of the things that I like to keep in mind is part of the reason this gets into the whole process of grants is part of the reason you were hearing the expedition, why we want to get it out there and try to get things done quickly with the right accountability, is that because sometimes in the past when we've asked agencies to do things and give them grant awards, sometimes it's taken months or sometimes years before they get rolled out. And that's so when you see some of this out there, this is some of where it drives those kind of things, letting people know this is important to us and this is why we word it the way it is. And so those are things I want us to keep in mind as we continue to approach this going forward. And, you know, particularly for the small grants, I see, you know, not just small community organizations, but also small outstate rural communities that have got things that, you know, whether it's addressing issues that might be in the lake that we've got being addressed here or those kind of things where they don't need huge dollars, but it's, you know, a $10,000 grant for some of these small communities, that's a big chunk of their budget, or some of these counties that are working with it. And so that's where it's important, is that we have that opportunity to be able to have these small grants out there. It's important that we take a look at the risk assessment. And I'm going to be curious to learn more as we do risk assessment going forward, because that is part of it. And I think one of the things that can help us get there where we can get a win together is, you heard the question I asked before on a surety or a fidelity bond. I think this is something that right now we don't have that spelled out as mandated anywhere. I think it's time that we start putting that in, at least in this program, because I'm hearing concerns from people as well. What happens if they, you know, where's the accountability? And there's going to be a point, because you cannot guarantee there's never going to be fraud, because every day there's somebody trying to perpetrate fraud on government, on ourselves, or somebody else. We see it regularly. The important thing is we want to make sure the projects are successful, number one, and number two, we've got accountability for our tax dollars. And so the accountability side, I think, comes to the fidelity bond issue, is that we should have a requirement out there that there should be fidelity bonds slash surety bonds, and they get labeled differently. They've changed over my career in the private industry and nonprofit world, where that can give that satisfaction that if something goes wrong, we've got somewhere else to go to get that. And I've seen that work successfully in nonprofit organizations, where something occurs, you've got that bond out there, you've got that relationship, and it's through your normal insurance package. I know with smaller companies, smaller organizations, that might be a little bit more challenging. But I think that's one of the things I'd look for, is, and that probably be something that we'd want to put in as guardrails on our side, is some proposal to have that requirement, and at least for this program as we're starting out, and making that as an allowable use for reimbursement, because particularly for some of these smaller organizations, they may not be able to afford that. I know that now our organization was several million dollars, and so it was something that was part of our package, really didn't cost us much of anything. That might change with others. So you're getting kind of an idea where some of the things that you might see coming from a proposal that we might have coming out to start getting at this, but I also know there may be other work. So with that, I will stop there and turn it over to my co-chair.
I'd like to thank all of you for being here today from DNR. And in a spirit of attempting to make sure, again, that this program is rolled out in the very best possible way, we will invite the OLA come to the desk. Assistant Commissioner, if you have any closing comments, feel free.
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Fisher, members, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for giving us time to present our recommendations. Thank you for reading our recommendations. Thank you for your input on this. And we look forward to working with you into the future to make sure this grant program works. So just thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. Thank you.
Out of your way.
Auditor Randall, it is a pleasure to have you before the committee today. And I want to thank again Ms. Thiessen for being here as well. I think you've heard some of the discussion, if not all of it. And the question that I would have for you, and it may form into a more formal request in the coming days, but if you had any suggestions after hearing testimony and discussion, that anything that came to mind that we need to be considering together, and I think that you probably can see also that Chair Fisher and I are very collaborative in this, and your testimony today here is of great value. So whatever you might have, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor. Nice to see all of you, and thanks for having us here today. Yes, I was here the whole time and listened. So we have some thoughts, and then, of course, happy to have further conversation and answer your questions. First, and I'm not just brown nosing, like, I think this was a fabulous conversation, and this is, like, exactly the type of thing that I think the legislature needs to do, especially as you're standing up a program. I mean, doing this on the front end is so important. It is so much better to establish the program that is strong, that can help prevent against misuse rather than do a pay and chase, right? So I just really want to commend you on this really thoughtful discussion and a genuine interest to make sure we get this right, because it's important and it's going to be around for a long time. I think that that's the idea, at least hopefully. So I think where I want to start is the conversation was kind of an all or nothing conversation, it seemed to me. You know, if it's over 50,000, then all the OGM policies apply, and if it's under 50,000, none of them apply. But I think that's not a paradigm we have to follow here. I think you get to decide what you want. And so, I mean, that's why you're having this hearing, right? And so if there's grants that are under 50,000, you could require some additional oversight. OGM doesn't dictate what you all put in as oversight requirements. So I will just put that out there. And I think an idea to be just thoughtful about what do you want to achieve? Is it, in terms of the oversight stuff, is it protecting the money? Is that the most important thing? I mean, believe me, I think that's important. We're Office of the Legislative Auditor, right? But
it ranks pretty high.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it, let me finish. I mean, I know I interrupted myself, but Mr. Chair, is it protecting the money? Is it the outcomes we're trying to get, right? And the scientific follow-up that Representative Hansen was talking about. And my guess is it's both, right? I'm sure we want both. And, you know, you could spend a lot of money to protect every single dollar, and you could spend a lot of money to ensure rigorous, you know, scientific outcomes are demonstrated on every dollar. So you have to make choices, right? And finding that balance. And so as we've been looking across state government and how do we ensure program integrity and what that means, we're really trying to emphasize that agencies and you all now look at things through a risk assessment lens, right? Because you're not going to require DNR to do a site visit on every single grant every day, every month, right? It's just cost prohibitive and it's not the value. But you probably do want them to do oversight on grants that are risky. And risk isn't just the size of the grant. It's not just dollars. It's maybe it's a new grantee. Maybe it's, gosh, when they started, they didn't really seem like they knew, you know, what they were doing or what they signed up for. There's lots of different ways to identify risk. We have past performance with grantees. We have data on grantees. We have data on similar types of projects. And so I think it is a very reasonable ask of the department to say, okay, come to us with or develop a thoughtful method that you are going to use to determine risk. And those that you identify as higher risk are going to have to, you're going to have to provide this type of extra oversight. Right? And again, you can look through the OGM policies, the menu of 13 policies, and say, these are the ones that we think as a committee are really important, and we want them done whether it's over 50,000 or under 50,000. I mean, monitoring visits, I think that's one of the number one ways to see if what you're paying for is what you're getting. Ideally, they're unannounced, and ideally, they're in person. But sometimes you can get good information remote, you know, not in person. I'm a fan of in-person site visits, period. But, you know, you can have those discussions. Progress reports, you know, simply just requiring the grantee to submit a progress report in a year or halfway through the grant period to say, this is what we've accomplished. It gives the agency something to hold the grantee accountable to. I think that's part of what we're looking for, too, is giving the agency some ways to hook in so that they can hold a grantee accountable, you know, if there are questions raised, right? What were we trying to achieve? Are you achieving it? What did you say you did? Can you prove it, right? These types of scaffolding for oversight. Let me see what my other notes are. So my notes are right size oversight based on risk, which we've talked about. One other comment I'll just say, I know you directed DNR to base it on the CPL grants. You know, do you all agree with the expedited grant approach? I don't know. I don't think that was in the law. And so, I mean, that's something that DNR presented. Do you agree with it? I don't know. But it's up to you. You know, you have the ability to say you don't want to do that if you don't want to do it. And if you do want to do it, you have the ability to say what types of oversight you want them to provide, regardless of the dollar amount. I think those are my highlights. Okay, I got the nod. That means good. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm happy to have offline conversations. I would just really encourage you to I just saw one other note. Sorry. the culture of an agency is so important, right, to prioritize compliance, to approach things with some skepticism, right? The whole thing was, you know, trust and verify, that expression. I think we're kind of like, no, have skepticism and verify, and then maybe you can trust. And so having an agency look at its own practices and programs, you know, and put on the hat of a bad actor, right? Stress test their program, look for holes, see if there are vulnerabilities, and be proactive. I will say I have been very impressed with DNR and how they've responded to our Outdoor Heritage Fund audit, how they've responded today. I think they do have that culture of wanting to make sure grants are spent properly and the funding is used properly. Does that mean everything is perfect? Of course not, right? It's people, and it's a lot of expectations on them. But I feel more confident in the culture of DNR than maybe in some other agencies. But I think it's also good to encourage that culture to continue. Okay, now I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I really appreciate that, Auditor Randall. And, you know, as we're visiting, I think that Chair Fisher has suggested, whether it be a surety bond or what have you, I think that some of my suggestions might be more along the lines of, if you are going to ever have upfront money, there'd be multiple levels of more scrutiny. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all of our presenters giving us some insight on what this process has been as we build this. I too worked at a nonprofit and was the, you know, financially responsible person besides the board. And I moved away from using the language of grants when we got state, and I think one time we got a federal award, because it was always reimbursable. And that is a different category than, say, from a foundation, where then you would get that grant money up front and then there'd be a reporting process. So I know there's lots of different ways for doing this, and I'm wondering if you have looked at if other states have done this instead of that reimbursement process, if they've done upfront, or just sort of a landscape scan between all the different sources of money for something like a nonprofit, and sort of where, in your professional opinion, kind of this structure as it stands matches up to all of the sort of potential structures that we might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Auditor Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Purcell, for the question. I think it's a great question, and language is really important in these matters. It's really important. One of the findings we had in a recent performance audit was the legislature authorized a payment to an entity. This was in our behavioral health audit. And because the language was payment, none of the Office of Grants Management policies or oversight were triggered. And so we went to, it was pulled as part of our sample, and we said, so where's the oversight file? And they said, well, it's not a grant. And we said, well, it looks like a grant, smells like a grant, you know, and they said, well, it's payment. And so we couldn't hold them to any of the grants management standards because the language didn't say grant. So language is really important. And I understand the the confusion with how a foundation grants, but sitting here in this seat, I would say please use the word grant. Please, please, please use the word grant because that triggers, you know, the 16B, 98, 981, all of those laws that this body has spent a lot of time and effort developing in just the past couple of years. So, and in terms of what other states do, I would say I haven't looked across in a while, but last time I did, Minnesota used grants way more than many, many other states. So we're kind of a leader, question mark, in our use of them.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, I think we were in that audit report when it was presented. We heard the report and the issue of the words payment. I think you tracked that down where it came from, and it came from the other body, if I remember correctly. Do you remember that correctly?
Randall, you're on thin ice. Careful. This is dangerous.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, you're putting me on the hot seat. I don't recall that particular one, but what I can tell you is we have seen several occasions of it. So if you point fingers, you know what they say, you point one, four, three, four, point back, so.
Chair Fisher, if you would like to have closing comments for...
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Thank you to the DNR and Auditor Randall and your team, everyone, for being here. This is really important work, and I appreciate the robust discussion. One of the things that I took away from when you were presenting earlier in DHS is sometimes the problem is ourselves. We didn't write the guardrails properly to start with. And so one of the thing I would offer, and I know that Co-Chair Heintzman is very much on the same wavelength, are there things that we should have in law right now that we're setting up in statute that we should have right now that we don't? And that would be something if you could take some time and take a look at what we've got right now that would help give some comfort. As you can see, there's going to be at least one or two things we're going to pop out here, but it'll be like we're trying to get ahead of it, and so we appreciate your thoughtfulness and guidance to help us as we make sure we get this rolled out properly. Thank you.
Auditor Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Fisher. I appreciate the invitation, and we will take a deeper look at the law and see if we have any suggestions, and we'll share those with you. Thanks.
Auditor Randall, I think you could consider that a formal request from both chairs of the Environment Committee to formally produce a recommendation addressing the questions that have been raised today. Members, I'm not seeing any more questions. I feel like today was a really good opportunity and really good collaborative effort together. That probably an example for numerous other subject areas and committees, I might say, as to how to get at this issue. I would also echo some of the comments that have been made recognizing DNR as being a great partner in this process and their responses to the concerns that have been raised have been very, I think, positive. Auditor Randall, Ms. Deason, really, really grateful for your thoughtful input, and we will continue to visit with your office and look forward to your recommendations. Members, we are adjourned.